touchdown machine for the Houston Cougars.
Sasser again, just kind of taking over right now.
That's NBA stuff right there. He is a baller.
Stick it in your pipe and smoke it, baby.
Yes! Welcome to Scott Lund Podcast. We are back on a Friday evening, quite the unusual spot for the two of us to be in to talk all things non-football about your Houston Cougars. If you haven't already, your window is pretty tight because it's too late now. I would say that. I think you have most of Saturday. Certainly, if you were driving up to Dallas, I would very much recommend not just this episode, but if you haven't already, our previous episode. I am one who likes to stack up podcasts before road trips, so please check out our last episode where we preview the SMU Mustangs and give our thoughts on the Cougar football win from last Saturday over the USF Bulls. But obviously, we have a lot to talk about that is not on the gridiron, the Cougar fall sports galore. And of course, a couple basketball programs, Cougar men's basketball, women's basketball, that I think we are quite excited to talk about. Dustin, it's 9:59 where you are, and we are about to cram as much into the show as possible. So I will do no more Bogarting of the microphone. How are you hanging in there, bud?
Sam, I'm excited. I'm not excited about the amount of sleep that I'm going to get tonight or the hour at which I'm going to go to bed tonight, but I'm excited to be talking to you for our 400th official episode, Sam. 400 Woo! Episodes, yeah. And not only that, but to have a really good Cougar volleyball team, a really good Cougar women's golf team to talk about, and to be previewing both men's and women's basketball, two teams I'm extremely excited for, who have their seasons opening on Monday. It's a good time to be a Cougar fan, Sam.
Yeah, it's the kind of athletic program that, you know, when we were about 390-something episodes ago, I don't know if we would have envisioned a top-to-bottom athletic program that was as good as it was. Obviously, when we started the show, we had quite the exciting football season, but top-to-bottom Houston Cougar Athletics certainly wasn't what it is now, and we're excited to talk about it. And I'm excited to tell you really quickly that we are proud members of the 1012 Network, talking all things Big 12 over there. Please follow them on the socials, as I always tell you, but if you haven't done already, please do so at TEN12 Network on Twitter, and please subscribe to the 1012 Podcast wherever you put podcasts in your ears. And of course, we are brought to you by the Go Folks of the Good brand, Homefield Apparel, homefieldapparel.com. Use our promo code HOLMAN12, HOLMAN12. That promo code will get you 15% off your first order of incredibly comfortable, incredibly unique vintage collegiate apparel, the kind of designs you're really not going to find anywhere else, a Cougar collection that was refreshed this year. If you haven't done so already, please check them out, homefieldapparel.com, promo code HOLMAN12, because you're not just looking good, but you're helping our show in the process. Everybody wins there. And speaking of an organizational body, Dustin, where winning is common, it's frequent, all they do is win, 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 no matter what. As a famous artist of our time once said, that's Houston Cougar volleyball, another 3-0 week. We're going to talk about an astonishing 4 matches, Dustin, since we've last talked about Cougar volleyball, and not a single set loss in there. Granted, this was probably a stretch of the schedule you should expect to go 4-0 against, but I think we could still zoom out a bit and appreciate this team's dominance, a dominance that really we haven't seen, a dominance that hasn't existed in this program since you and I were much, much younger than we already are.
Yeah, the last time we talked Cougar volleyball, it was actually, I guess, just me talking Cougar volleyball a week ago, and Houston at that time was 10-0, was making the turn into the back half of conference play, and if you thought for any reason that the rest of the American Athletic Conference was going to catch up to the Cougs on the second go-round after Houston went 10-0 through the first half of conference play, early evidence has not been in your favor that that was going to happen. As we saw, 4 dominant sweeps. Houston hosted a Temple team who, in Philly, was able to steal a set. They were within 4 points in 2 of Houston's set wins. At the Fertitta Center, the Cougs got a dominant 3-0 sweep. The Cougs hosted ECU and swept them for a second time, this one in 3 much less competitive sets. And then after Tulane pulled a near upset by taking the Cougs to 5 sets in New Orleans, this time around Houston swept them 25-15, 25-23, 25-21. And then just a few hours ago here on Friday evening, the Cougs traveled to Cincinnati, and after Houston needed 4 sets to beat the Bearcats at the Fertitta Center, they got the sweep on the road. And in the first match, you know, at the Fertitta Center, 2 of Houston's 3 set wins were really close this time. Really only the first set was very competitive, with Houston pulling away late and then feeling in control of sets 2 and 3. So really, really exciting week for Houston. They were really dominant, you know, both offensively and defensively. You know, average hitting percentage is about 205, and Houston's four wins, they hit 330, 356, 282, 211, while holding opponents to hitting just 074, 122, 131, 049. So, like you said, Sam, it's a match stretch of four matches that you expected to win. You expect to win basically every match because you beat everybody the first time around. Why not beat them again the second time around? But really remarkable the way in which Houston handled their business, getting sweeps and doing so in pretty dominant fashion.
And that had been something that tripped previous teams, previous good volleyball teams. That's something that's been, I think, really remarkable is how much David Rare raised the level of play immediately in this program when he got here in 2019. It was an immediate impact, I think, beyond what we would have expected optimistically. But you saw this team get tripped up by opponents that, you know, gave you losses bad enough to really just kind of blemish your postseason resume beyond anything close to an at-large. I think that's kind of your next step, really, agnostic of the sport. As a team, is to be a team that just so ruthlessly beats and beats comfortably the teams in your schedule you're supposed to beat, that you're not getting tripped up, that you're not kind of overawed by a situation where you kind of walk on the court and realize, yeah, we should be winning this match. We should probably not even be dropping a set in this match. I think something that was kind of telling as I put together my thoughts for this was I had to keep checking to see if, you know, one match or the other with the Temple match or the Cincy match from tonight, whether that was the season low for kills by an opponent. I mean, the Cougars were excellent in just about every aspect you could judge a team. I mean, if you win all 12 of the available sets, chances are you're probably doing more than one thing quite well. But I thought defensively, really incredible effort from a group that's had a lot of really incredible efforts. And I think it's because you're really good frontline players, your Abby Jacksons, your Kennedy Warrens, aren't afraid to do the defensive work as well, that whenever we're running off the individual stats, that, you know, you're seeing maybe your offensive players still contributing defensively in a positive way. It's not just Kate Georgiades who herself is quite good. So just a dominant week and what you expected, but I don't think we should take for granted the excellence we're witnessing from this team.
Yeah, and really another week where Houston's overall team depth really shown. We've talked about the setter platoon of Annie Cook and Morgan Yanda. You know, in addition to your primary offensive weapons of Abby Jackson and Isabel Toit, we saw strong attacking efforts from, you know, Rachel Tullis against ECU, Cortland Henderson against Temple, Kennedy Warren against Tulane and Cincinnati. You know, defensively up front, Tullis, Toit, and Kellen Moore in all multiple strong performances at the net. And kind of like you talked about, in addition to having star libero, K. Georgiades, you see other athletes like Yanda, Jackson, and Warren having real strong performances in terms of digs, getting up to or at all the way up to double, you know, or close to or up to double digits, even in just three set matches. So really excited by this team, not only continuing to get better and better, it seems, as the season goes along, but doing it by, you know, relying more and more on the overall depth on the roster and by being both strong offensively and defensively.
Yeah, and I thought really impressively that you were as dominant as you were the last two matches against Tulane and Cincy, with Isabel Toit not playing especially well or playing especially efficiently on the offensive end, which is fine because she's been absolutely fantastic for the season. It would be like dinging Marcus Sasser or, go back a few years, Quentin Grimes for having an off-night shooting. It happens. No offensive player in the country, even the very, very best, aren't going to have off nights, and that the Cougars can have such a critical player have an off night, and still comfortably win, to not ever really be in doubt of winning either of the matches this week, I think very impressive.
All right, so not this week yet. There's Houston actually done for this weekend already, so this coming weekend, the 11th and 13th, the Friday and Sunday, they'll be traveling, I should say, to Tulsa and Wichita State. In Houston, yeah, 14-0 in conference, only six matches left in the regular season. And I think, you know, we talked about it after the UCF win, Sam, that it felt like that was the win that kind of clinched Houston's postseason berth. But, you know, with six matches left, there's really only three that I can even see being any kind of struggle for Houston down the stretch. And even in the unlikely universe where they lose all three of those matches, which I don't think will happen, I think this is still an NCAA postseason resume that Houston will have put together. So really exciting to see this team finish up down the stretch here at Tulsa and Wichita this weekend, this coming weekend, as I mentioned. And, you know, I think a couple of matches that shouldn't be or at least the first one, really, at Tulsa shouldn't be a struggle. Houston comfortably swept the Golden Hurricane in Houston. Tulsa had lost 8 of their last 9 matches prior to. I didn't see what they did tonight against Temple, but you know, their prior result to that was getting swept at home by last place South Florida, just the Bulls' second win of conference play. You know, Wichita on Sunday figures to be a more competitive match. Shockers just 6-5 in conference play, behind, well behind the U of H, UCF, SMU triumvirate at the top of the standings, but one of two teams to take Houston to 5 sets thus far in AAC play, and it was by far the closer of those 2 5-setters, and it was at the Fertitta Center. So, you know, interesting matchup with the SMU. They just, you know, faced UCF at home on Sunday, took the first set before dropping the next 3. So, you know, with the rematch of against SMU coming at home for Houston, I think this is really the one match prior to UCF that scares me the most. And, you know, fortunately, while the Shockers are just 11-11 overall, they've played a tough strength of schedule. The RPI has rewarded them for it. They're a respectable 76th at last check. So this is a team that I think if they do spring the upset, it's not going to be one that completely ruins Houston's RPI and postseason resume.
I would go so far as to say there's only 2 matches that really concern me in the remaining schedule, but obviously one of them is that trip to Wichita State the Sunday after next. I would say certainly tougher than anyone before. Obviously, we see Central Florida, like you said, it was a close first match at the Fertitta Center. They Wichita actually took a set off UCF when they played in Wichita, I think, a few weeks ago. So certainly a team that's going to be, it's going to be ready for the Cougars. It's a team that you don't have to go too far back in their recent history to find it being a pretty high-level program. I want to say their first year in the American, they won the league and went to the NCAA tournament. So recent history there, and also a team that gave the Cougars problems last time. So yeah, curious to see what that one is. And yeah, probably, I'm not going to dismiss the possibility of SMU being maybe a challenging opponent. They did beat the Cougars at Fertitta last year, but I would say definitely your second hardest one on paper in the remaining regular season.
Yeah, you're kind of squinting at the schedule to say that there's 3 challenging remaining matches for Houston, but yeah, no, it like I said, Wichita going to be a challenge. If Houston can get that one, I feel even yet another level of relief about where this team is going to finish its regular season. Speaking of finishing their regular season, that would have been an amazing segue if I hadn't fumbled through it the first time. Cougar soccer did just that, finishing its regular season and by extension its season as a whole in high style with a 3-0 win over Temple on senior night. Cougs jumping out to an early 2-0 lead and tacking on a insurance goal in the second half to send their seniors out on a high note. And, you know, I already spoke at length last week in the episode about how disappointing it is to not be participating in the conference tournament. So while Sam, I don't know if you may understandably have some things to say there, I'm going to choose to have my my soccer notes for the night be strictly focusing on the positive, which is the way that Houston closed out the season. You know, despite Temple's winless AAC campaign, the 3-0 win for Houston was actually the largest margin of defeat that anybody in the conference had pinned on the Owls this year. Sam Weehee got things going with a free kick goal just about 4 minutes in. Janice Singleton made it 2-0 just 6 minutes later, and then just Singleton, one of the seniors who was honored on senior night, closed out scoring with a 67th minute goal to secure the brace and give the Cougs the 3-0 margin. And it was a win that was as comprehensive as the final score indicated. Houston had 17 shots to Temple's 3. So all in all, I think as strong a performance as you could hope for in Houston's last soccer match prior to joining the Big 12 Conference.
Yeah, it was nice to see them dominate Temple whistle to whistle, getting that 3-0 win. Really cool also, Yannis Singleton, one of the Cougar seniors that was honored, having 2 very nice goals, finishing with she took advantage of a poor free kick on the second one and had a really nice dribble in the first one to get past her defender to finish the one-on-one with the keeper. It was nice also to see the Cougars get a clean sheet in the season finale and just, like you said, dominate possession and chances like you should expect to against the conference's worst team. And I'm not going to belabor the point because I think you covered it pretty well in the sole episode, but I will just say, like you said, that's it for the 2022 season. And the Cougars finishing 8th out of 9, meaning they will not be qualifying for the postseason tournament by a pretty wide margin. I believe they are playing the finals tonight, actually, is Memphis and SMU. And I was even acknowledging the coaching change, even acknowledging that you lost some key players off of the fall 2021 team, a team that I think it's worth remembering was one bad penalty against USF away from winning the league regular season title outright. I feel like that's a pretty shocking drop. And if you had told me before the season this team would be kind of dropping to middle of the pack, I would have been disappointed, but you have to acknowledge it's a new coaching staff. I'd get it, but to go from nearly winning the league to only 2 wins in 8 conference matches, it's pretty shocking, and I gotta say, pretty disappointing. It wasn't a situation where the team graduated every single major contributor. A number of key contributors from last season were back, and yet we still saw a major backslide. And I think two things really concerned me the most coming out of the season. That in the prior two seasons, this one, the Cougars combined for 13 clean sheets in 31 combined matches. Only managed two such clean sheets in 16 this year. I have a hard time seeing that drop-off as anything but a red flag, that you had a number of experienced defensive holdovers and still fell off a cliff in that aspect of the game. And I think maybe the most concerning thing to me was the three head-to-head matchups you had against Big 12 opponents. And it did start out promisingly enough in the season opener. The Cougars actually nearly stole one against Oklahoma before a late goal spoiled it. It was a 1-1 draw, though probably not an unfair result considering how the Sooners dominated proceedings generally. In that one, Cougs lose their home opener 3-0 to what was a bad, bad, bad Baylor team. Came into that one with almost an entirely new roster early in the season. A week later, lost 3-0 to Texas Tech and just was very uncompetitive in that game. Not to mention losing to and getting shut out by the two other AAC programs that will be departing with you to the Big 12. And I realize this is Jaime Frias and the staff's first year at U of H, but I think it's worth doing a quick comparison of this season and Diego Bocanegra's first season in 2017. In 2017, Dustin, the Cougars were 20 spots higher in the season-ending RPI, had more conference wins, including a top 25 win over Cincy, and unlike this season, they weren't coming off the best season in school history. They were coming off one conference win in the total of four seasons prior. You know, I really hope I'm wrong. In a year from now, we see an improved team, a team that looks like they could be competitive against Big 12 opponents, but I haven't just seen much in the way of hard evidence that's going to happen. Again, would really love to be wrong and for the season to just wind up being a weird transition year rather than being indicative of anything long term, but it's kind of hard to see it as not a negative sign long term that the team dropped off so much from the program's best season a year ago.
All right, well, I think that that covers it. Moving right along, as we've got lots to talk to, another team that finished up its season since our last episode is the Cougar Cross Country program, which did compete at AAC Championships. And kind of interestingly, heading into this one, the Cougar women were on a three-year run of always finishing eighth at AAC Championships. The men were on a two-year run of finishing seventh, and they swapped. The women took seventh, the men took eighth this time around. And the clear highlight of the event was Claire Meyer, who had led the way for Houston all year as a senior. She finished 12th overall on the individual leaderboard. That was the highest finish for a Cougar woman since the school joined the American. The finish was also good enough to make her the school's first women's all-AAC selection. On the men's side, senior Brandon Seagreaves leading the Cougs once again, finishing 32nd for overall. So nice performance by Meyer, Sam. Nice highlight there. But all in all, the team level, kind of the same thing that you generally expect from Houston when it comes to AAC championships for cross country.
Yeah, and the team level kind of the same as it's generally been for this program. Though, again, worth shouting out Claire Meyer, who had had a pretty fantastic season prior to the championship and being doing something that no Cougar athlete had done in this conference previously. I think that's really, really cool and hopefully indicative of her having a good rest of the season going forward into indoors and outdoors.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with Cougar with the Cougar cross country program going forward as Houston joins the Big 12. Your best athletes on both the men's and women's teams were seniors this year, and head coach Ray Stanfield retired midway through the season. Houston finished the season with an interim head coach, so shoes to replace in year one as a Big 12 member in terms of both athletes and coaches. But in terms of Cougar track and field, we'll see them back in action in a couple months, middle of January, when indoor season gets underway. So looking forward to that. And then also looking forward to seeing more from Cougar Women's Golf, who finished out their fall season with a seventh place finish out of 17 teams at the Battle of the Beach. This was a loaded field, as I mentioned last week, so a seventh place finish, not a bad thing for the Cougs by any stretch at all. Four of the six teams to finish ahead of Houston were ranked 16th or better, excuse me, in the country, and the Cougs finished ahead of number 23 Baylor, number 24 Arkansas, among others. Freshman Moa Swedenskild followed up her individual title in the Gym West Challenge by tying for sixth place on the individual leaderboard to pace the Cougs. Fellow freshman Natalie St. Germain a stroke behind her to also finish in the top 10. So, Sam, I was a little surprised and disappointed to see Houston drop a couple spots from 23 to 27 in the golf stat team rankings after this one, which I said, I thought was a pretty respectable result in a competitive field. But nonetheless, have to be happy with where the Cougs are as their fall season finishes with this one.
Yeah, I can't say enough good things about what the Cougs have done, primarily these two awesome freshmen, Svedensky Old and Natalie St. Germain. St. Germain just one stroke behind her fellow freshman, coming off of Svedensky Old winning the Jim West Challenge in the previous event. Yeah, that you could debate that this was maybe the worst performance of the fall season. And the worst performance of the fall season is finishing 7th out of 17 in an absolutely stacked field. I think tells you how good this team is. I agree with you. Don't know how you could justify knocking them out of the top 25, but not going to freak out about that. During the fall, I think we've tried to keep our expectations in a realistic place, but seeing this team really kick butt in some stacked fall events and that two of your freshmen really look like they're going to be stars for the rest of the season, years after that to come, it's hard to keep your expectations grounded after the kind of fall this team had. But yeah, I welcome that. I love to have, I think before the first fall event, didn't expect to be talking about how we felt this team was hard done not to be in the top 25, which I think tells you how good these last several events have been.
All right, and then before we get into our hoops preview, we're going to talk some interesting Big 12 news that is certainly worth warrants mentioning. And we're going to start with Houston getting some news. It's not official yet, but Joseph Duarte, among other, I believe, is... actually, I'm not sure if anyone else was reporting him, but Joseph Duarte at least reporting that Houston's first Big 12 conference football game will be a home game against TCU next year, and also grabbing more eyeballs and attention that the Cougs will be hosting the Longhorns in football next year. Houston also reportedly going to host Texas Tech and has a road trip to Baylor. So I think making sure that Houston did a full round robin against all the other Texas schools felt like an obvious thing to get right, but I'm nonetheless happy to see that it looks like the Big 12 did do that. And you know, it is, I think, also worth mentioning, nothing is official yet. The full schedule is expected to be released in December, and you know, I think you and I have always said that we won't believe that Houston is going to host the Longhorns until the game is literally on the schedule written down. But you know, the SEC has already released their 2023 schedules without the Longhorns and the Sooners on them, and you know, I've been wrong repeatedly about conference realignment stuff, Sam, but it sure doesn't feel like there's going to be any last second mega buyout coming here. So I think we are actually, I think we can fairly comfortably say Houston is going to host the UT Longhorns in football next year.
Yeah, barring some catastrophic news, I'm willing to, like you, actually believe it's going to happen. And certainly getting that burnt orange school in Houston one more time before they move on to the SEC is going to be nice. I think we're very much of the mind that any and all conference games for the first Big 12 season should be held on campus, unless we're talking about absolutely unprecedented FU levels of money to host it at a neutral site. And even then, man, I really, really like to, you know, have the full home slate at least that first year get played at TDECU Stadium, to get these big opponents that we've been just dying to have at this nice new on-campus stadium. The home schedule, I think, that we've been waiting for many, many years, even before the construction of the shiny new stadium. I'm also curious to see, when we get the full release, which out-of-state games end up being roadies. My hope is that we only get UCF or Cincy rather than both, because that's no disrespect to either program, because both of those have been better programs than the Cougars the last several years. I just like to have as many new opponents on the league schedule as possible, and I would imagine those two schools feel similarly about the idea of playing U of H versus playing the other Big 12 Texas schools. I'm also personally hoping for a BYU roadie in those nine conference games, but a bit of bias there, as it would be the only drivable roadie for me at present time, though. Really exciting, just consider the juice of all of these potential opponents. Even if we end up playing both UCF and Cincy, those are still two really good programs, and at minimum you're going to have seven new teams that, with the exception of maybe Texas Tech, you just really haven't seen the Cougars go head-to-head against for a good long while, and I think that's very exciting.
Yeah, I want to just reiterate something you said there, which was that the University of Houston needs to play their home football games only exclusively at TDECU Stadium in 2023. And yes, I get that there is going to be likely, you know, huge financial incentives for Houston to play one or more home games away from TDECU in a larger venue where they can sell more tickets. But this fan base has waited too long to play a schedule like this. Every time you take a game away from TDECU, you're moving it from a venue where you can ensure that the majority of tickets are going to go to, you know, season ticket holders and U of H fans, make them part of mini plans, things like that. You know, but just absolutely every Big 12 school has a ton of fans, has a ton of alumni in Houston. And, it can maybe be more money if you play a game at NRG, but, you know, the point of making money as an athletic department is to turn that money into winning games. You have a better chance of winning games in your home stadium in a pro U of H atmosphere than at NRG with a crowd that's likely for some of these games going to be closer to 50-50. So, you know, yes, down the line, are certain big games going to get moved to NRG? Sure, fine. I don't love it, but I acknowledge the utility of having a larger stadium right there for a school that still needs to prove that it can fill TDECU regularly, but, you know, has certainly proven that it'll warrant NRG when it faces a big name opponent. But like I said, 2023 needs to be on campus, so let's everyone make sure that that happens. And then moving right along, the other Big 12 news worth mentioning for sure, the Big 12 securing its media future with a deal with ESPN and Fox. In the new deal, Big 12 schools will make actually more money than they were making in the previous deal with UT Austin and Oklahoma in the conference. They will pay out a little under $32 million per school, which when combined with college football playoff payouts, bowl payouts, money from basketball tournament payouts, expected to be in excess of $50 million per school in terms of total media revenue once the college football playoff expands at the very least. So for context, this year, the Big 12 distributed a record $42.6 million in total media rights. And you know, I think very notable that former Big 12 Commissioner Bob Bowlesby, about a year ago, it was really not that long in the most recent past, someone who is allegedly was supposed to be an advocate for the Big 12, estimated
that estimated
that the Big 12 would lose half of its media value when OUT left. New Commissioner Brett Yormark said the opposite. He said he was going to get a deal that provided more money for the returning Big 12 schools, not less. And a very non-zero number of sports media types laughed at him for saying that, and he ended up doing exactly that. So, you know, notably, the new schools like U of H won't get a full payout until 2025, which is when that new deal starts. Anyway, the $31.6 million that we reported is going to be actually $18 million in 2023 and $19 million in 2024, plus those other revenue streams that we mentioned there. So, but even still, that's already a huge step up from the AAC paying out about $8 million this year. So exciting to see some tangible numbers for something that Houston kind of knew they needed, which was a big increase in the amount of media rights revenue, and seeing that Yormark knew what he was talking about when he said he was going to get increased payouts for even the holdover Big 12 schools is very nice to see that tangibly, you know, something that Houston can rely on now.
Completely independent of you, I had heard that same Bob Bowlesby quote. I was like, he surely didn't undersell the conference that he's allegedly a commissioner of by half its revenue. I went and looked it up, and the tiniest bit of context here is that it was the various Big 12 parties going before Texas lawmakers and trying to put up a sob story. I think Mac Rhodes said a bunch of stuff about how, you know, they wouldn't sell nearly as many season tickets and couldn't do nearly all these capital projects if they weren't playing a Power 5 schedule, which they said that the two departing schools were robbing them of. And I think it kind of, in the most general level, kind of speaks to why you have someone from maybe the business and outside entertainment world versus somebody in Bob Bowlesby's case who was just entrenched in the world of college athletics his entire adult professional life and just didn't seem to be adjusting to the times. I think the most eye-opening thing for me, I think like everybody, was that Brett Yormark got more money, even if you think it was a token increase in money or, you know, in inflation adjustment, that he got more money despite those two big brand names leaving for the SEC, I think is a win on its own, a massive win. And of course, U of H and the two departing AAC schools were going to get a pretty massive increase in media rights revenue. I think even if the Big 12 saw a drop in what they were getting in terms of per school payout, it was going to be a pretty decent increase for the Cougars, for UCF, and for Cincinnati. You know, just to get from, you know, get from where Bob Bowlesby said this conference was just over a year ago to where it expected a 50% reduction in TV money to getting an increase, it's nothing short of, I think, negotiating wizardry from Yormark, who I think I've gone out of my way not to be like, ooh, did you see this quote for Brett Yormark on game day? I mean, I'll just be honest. I don't give a shit what the conference commissioner says or does outside of things like this, outside of wins like this. I'm not interested in what he says about brand synergy or what he said in this article or this TV interview on this ESPN program. I care about this stuff, and this stuff he absolutely just hit out of the park. I think the only thing I've seen even close to a critique is that, you know, a few people saying, well, it's not in the same ballpark as the Big Ten or SEC deals, which I think kind of feels like a bad faith critique, considering I think nobody in their right mind was expecting the Big 12 to command the kind of stupid money the Big Ten and SEC are getting. But I think just lots of really excited you know, things to be exciting stuff if you're a U of H fan. The competition level's increasing. Opponent matchups are going to get a lot more exciting, like we just got done talking about a bit ago. And the athletic department's going to be bringing in a good amount more money. I think it's just wins all around. And no matter what season-specific stuff on the field is, you know, making you unhappy or happy, it's nice to just know that in the intermediate future, for the first time in almost 30 years, this program is going to definitely be more part of the haves and the have-nots when it comes to college athletics. And I think don't lose sight of that in whatever from the thing from the current athletic season is annoying you, to kind of don't miss the forest for the trees.
Yeah, and again, certainly it's not going to be Big Ten or SEC money. We never expected it was going to be Big Ten or SEC money, but it compares nicely to what the ACC is making. The Pac-12, from what I've heard, is expected to get a similar amount in their upcoming deal, although that's expected to be a deal that's likely going to include more streaming compared to the Big 12 getting the majority of its games on actual TV networks like the ESPN Family Networks and Fox, FS1, that kind of thing. So, like I said, very exciting to see hard numbers. Nice to see that ESPN and Fox view the Big 12 as a valuable entity. But I think that kind of gets us to the next question, which is the question everybody still has on their mind, which is, you know, what does this deal mean in terms of the ongoing Big 12, Pac-12, will they, won't they affair? And, you know, the reporting is that the deal has a pro rata clause, so that if the Big 12 adds new schools, it would make proportionally, more money overall, such that each school still made the same amount. But there are two big caveats, the first one being that this clause only applies to schools currently in the Power 5, so realistically only applies to schools currently in the Pac-10, and then also that the pro rata clause only applies to ESPN's half of the deal, not Fox's. In other words, you're only actually getting about two-thirds as much per school if you add a new school. So if you do add new schools while this deal is in place and offer them full shares, then everybody's going to have to take a little bit of a cut around the boards, across the board. So, you know, that plus the fact that, like I said, it sounds like the Pac-12 will come out at around a pretty similar number kind of makes Big 12 expansion seem unlikely in the near future. But I think there is a pro expansion argument to be made here, and it has to do with, you know, I think stability and visibility in the Big 12's next deal. You know, the Big 12's deal reportedly does include a grant of rights, which is the thing that is so strong that it's sure looks like it's going to keep even OU and UT from leaving early. And that's something that Oregon and Washington are reportedly not willing to include in the Pac-12's next media deal, as they hope for an invite from the Big 10. And when you're at 10 teams, you're one or two defections away from not really having a viable conference and having to, dip down into adding G5 schools that are, you know, when there really aren't any that are going to not dilute your conference's overall value. So, you know, if you're Arizona, for example, are you willing to make the move and get into a conference that looks more settled in the long term as opposed to, constantly waiting for the Big Ten axe to fall? And then, as mentioned, you know, the Pac-12's media deal expected to be a split between ESPN and Amazon, which means a high number of Pac-12 games available only on streaming. And yes, we are seeing more and more people cut cords and streaming is increasing in popularity, but as of right now, games on major TV networks still crush streaming in terms of overall viewership numbers. So if you're a Pac-12 school, are you tired of the fiasco that was the Pac-12 networks? Or, you know, how few people nationally are able to watch your games? And are you excited about the idea of going and telling your fans, hey, that you're going to need an Amazon subscription maybe to watch, you know, maybe half of your team's games in the future? And then finally, Sam, before I turn it back to you, as I've been talking for a while here, I think, you know, if you're wondering if the Big 12 would even want to expand, if it means that each school is going to get a slightly smaller number, in the near future, I think there's the argument to be made from our side, too, which is that, you know, the deal that your Mark made here is that it's a pretty short-term deal. It's a six-year extension from 2025 to 2031. It will make the Big 12 one of the first conferences to go to market in the next cycle of deals. And you've heard your Mark talk about wanting to make the Big 12 a national conference, a national brand. So, you know, as impressive as it was getting this deal done, you know, I'm sure you'd love to give your Mark the leverage in the next deal of having a truly national brand coast-to-coast to sell the next time around.
Yeah, I don't think I have a ton to add beyond that. I think this stops a really short-term expansion. I think it stops us from a week from now coming back here and be like, wow, did you see the Big 12 added the four corner schools? I feel like that stopped that for the immediate future. But for all the reasons you said, I think there are definitely scenarios where you could see the four corner schools ending up in a more stable situation, potentially with the Big 12. It's just hard to guarantee stability without being one of the absolute elites of the sport. So I guess your SEC, your Big 10 at this point, or in the case of the ACC, signing a very long, very cost prohibitive to get out of kind of a TV agreement among the partners. So yeah, I don't think we're done with that in the long term, but I think we're done with it in terms of keeping an eye on the news cycle and thinking maybe this is the domino that falls there. But yeah, I mean, I guess if Washington and Oregon get a Big Ten invite next week, I think I'm obviously going to be singing a bit of a different tune.
And then speaking of perhaps maybe far off realignment, did at least want to mention while we're talking Big 12 that the conference, Brett Yarmark reportedly having preliminary talks with Gonzaga. Yarmark met with Gonzaga's AD recently. And sure, like I said, sounds like talks were very much preliminary. But, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if there is mutual interest between Gonzaga and the Big 12. You know, on Gonzaga's side, you get, you know, a lot more legitimacy for your strength of schedule. You go from, you know, basically taking a couple months mostly off in between, you know, the end of what's usually a very challenging non-conference schedule for the Zags and the NCAA tournament by basically just laying waste to the West Coast Conference once more. And, you know, on the Big 12 side, you get to add one of the most impressive men's basketball programs in the country, one that would somehow actually improve what already looks like a historically good, historically deep men's hoops conference, would actually give the Big 12 the schools that finished 1, 2, 3, and 4 in KenPom last year. So a lot of questions to be answered. You know, having an odd number of teams is kind of a pain in the ass. How do you handle that? You know, do you make this decision before or after your, you know, Pac-12 flirtation either happens or fizzles out finally? How does this affect your media deal? You know, it's a big question. But, you know, I think if you can find a way to add Gonzaga, it's a movie that you would want to do. It's certainly behooves Brett Yarmark to do his due diligence on seeing what it would take to make this one happen, Sam.
Yeah, and I'm not going to repeat my entire, I think, rant on Twitter about it, but I do feel like this story was framed as, ooh, Gonzaga's about to join the Big 12, and then once it was reported out a bit more, I was like, okay, Brett Yarmark and Gonzaga's AD had an exploratory conversation while the Gonzaga AD was near Yarmark's home turf in DFW, but again, I think it's a credit to Yarmark, and I think shows that he might be a good guy for this job, that he is out there having that conversation, even if it's not a move he can make in the immediate future. And yeah, co-sign everything you said. It would make the absolute, I would still say at this point, debatably best conference, best more years than not in men's basketball. I think it would lock them into that number one spot the same way people kind of perceive it to be with the SEC in football. We'll point out, we'll throw just a tiny bit of cold water. Spokane is not Seattle, Dustin. Spokane, you know this, having lived on this side of the country a bit. I think your dad lives out in Washington State. Now, Spokane is not a hop and a skip away from the Seattle International Airport. And I'm not sure how you totally justify the logistics. And I know we're in a world where UCLA and USC are going to be occasionally playing conference games against Rutgers and Maryland here in the next couple of years. But having a UCF, let's just say women's soccer team, go all the way to Spokane and vice versa, I think is pretty crazy town. But I guess that's kind of where we are in college athletics right now. It would certainly make the men's basketball product great. And I think Gonzaga has a better top to bottom athletic department than most people realize. They're quite a good women's basketball team and a good baseball team, more years than not.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why I said I think it's interesting if the Gonzaga question happens before or after the Pac-12 question, because I think it, as much as, yeah, it doesn't completely change the logistics of having to get, like you said, you know, women's volleyball teams out to Spokane or whatever, but, you know, I think if you add some of the Western schools out there in the Pac-12, then certainly it makes the whole Western wing a little bit more feasible and makes you know, Gonzaga make a little bit more geographic sense, but definitely feels like a question that's probably a couple of years down the road from really needing to figure out where they're going.
Yep, no doubt.
All right, Sam, we've got men's and women's basketball to do some season previews for, so let's go ahead and jump into those, starting with the Cougar men's basketball team. I have to say the one word that just jumps out to me about this Cougar team as we are now just a couple days away from the season starting is expectations. I mean, they were already really high last year coming off of a Final Four appearance. And while the Cougs, and I'm being extremely ironic here, only made it to the Elite Eight last year, you know, getting Marcus Sasser back, bringing in an unprecedented recruiting class, and with the knowledge that the upcoming Final Four will be held in Houston, you know, I'd argue that expectations are even higher heading into the season than they were last year, and that's certainly backed up by the preseason accolades that are coming Houston's way. The Cougs were ranked 15 in the AP poll heading into last year. They're coming number 3 heading into the season. It's backed up by the betting markets, which have the Cougs, Gonzaga, and UNC as the top tier of teams favorites to win the national championship. You know, and you've seen Marcus Sasser named to multiple first-team All-American teams. He's on the watch list for, I think, every major award he's eligible for. And you know, and ultimately, you want to have expectations. If you have good players and a good team and you're coming off of a good year, you're going to have to deal with expectations. And while there's no coach I'd rather have navigate the waters of insanely high expectations than Kelvin Sampson, that doesn't mean it's not something you have to worry about. And it's not just, I think, talking about expectations in terms of worrying about Houston players losing focus. It's something that you saw Kelvin Sampson talk about recently. Houston has become the team that is the marquee matchup on everybody's schedule. And, you know, I remember back in Conference USA days when Memphis was this big national power and, you know, you see students camping out early to get in early because it's the one game that everyone would show up for and make a huge atmosphere for. And that's what this Houston team, the team gets now. This is the team that is every team's going to want to make their name by beating us. Every guard we play is going to want to make their name by, you know, shutting down and outplaying Marcus Sasser. And that's a lot to deal with. Houston has a schedule where, you know, according to Ken Pom's preseason rankings, they'll only be an underdog once, and they'll be favored by double digits in 20 of their 31 regular season games. So there will be a lot of games where Houston has a pretty decided edge in terms of overall talent and in terms of, you know, coaching ability quite often. But Sam, this is a team that is not going to be able to take many nights off because you are going to get absolutely everybody's best shot.
I think in a weird roundabout way, we got here with this team because of what was at the time some objectively terrible news, the news that we got last December that Marcus Sasser would be missing the rest of the season because of a foot injury that he had suffered not that long after we got the other bad news that Tremont Mark was also going to miss the remainder of the season due to a shoulder injury. And that team, kind of like you talked about, despite missing those top two anticipated guards, thrived thanks to the emergence of Jamal Shez, an elite defender and point guard, and the veteran presence of guys who are no longer here, like Kyler Edwards, Josh Carlton, Tajay Moore, and Fabian White Jr. I think we still would have been very bullish on this year's team if Marcus Sasser, you know, ends up playing last year and whatever happens last year, or just decide to call it a college career after the real life injury he suffered, because you'd still be returning Jamal Shed. You'd still be returning Tremont Mark along with other contributors from last year's U of H team. And oh, by the way, adding the highest rated recruiting class that Kelvin Sampson's staff has brought since arriving at U of H. But to have all of that and return a multi-year starting guard in Marcus Sasser, who was having, I think, an All-American type season before he got hurt last year, you know, that's the kind of team that should be in the preseason number one conversations, like this Cougar team has been coming to the season. I think what excites me most about this team is just, it's the combination of veteran presence and the infusion of talent you're going to get from the arrival of guys like Jairus Walker and Terrence Arsenault. And oh, by the way, let's not forget Emmanuel Sharpe, a top 100 recruit who was with this program last semester, because I think that general description, the veteran presence and young talent, that's kind of the sweet spot for any team that fancies itself a serious contender to win the whole thing. You know, I mean, with the occasional exceptions, you look back at recent national championship winning teams, you can't rely solely on a highly recruited redshirt freshman. Maybe Calipari's one national championship team at Kentucky excepted. You can't solely rely on veterans, though the Villanova teams of the recent past might make some argument there, although I think those Villanova teams were also quite talented. But if you look at the makeup of the majority of all those recent champions, it's been that mix of proven veteran contributors and talented freshmen, while having a number of guys who were at least right around that four-star, top 100-ish kind of level as a recruit. And this is in no way me slighting previous U of H teams, but this overall roster talent is different than it was 4 or 5 years ago. And acknowledging that, again, you can't simply have nothing but good veterans. You can't simply have nothing but blue chip recruits. And having that good balance like the Cougars have certainly doesn't guarantee you're going to win the whole thing or even get a trip to the Final Four. But I feel like it's an important prerequisite. And I don't know if it's a prerequisite that any of Kelvin Sampson's prior U of H teams met, or at least met to the degree that this team does.
Yeah, I think one of the big reasons that Houston's one of the, you know, favorites to win the national championship is that mix of, you know, veterans and youngsters like you talked about. And then also, as we kind of get to the roster breakdown, it's this guard group, you know, which national writers have consistently rated, you know, right up there with North Carolina. Usually, you know, Houston and UNC in some order are one and two in terms of the best and second best guard groups in the country. And certainly, like you said, it starts with Marcus Sasser. You know, at this point, what else can you say about him? He's an elite shooter, phenomenal defender, really grown as a distributor. I think if he can show even continued improvement in the playmaking department, he could very well be the best guard in the country. And, you know, having Marcus Sasser back when he could have gotten drafted and, you know, been on an NBA roster means that you have essentially an NBA caliber player on your college roster. And I just could not be more excited to watch him play this year. You know, two things we haven't really seen yet for Houston prior to the season, kind of like you talked about with that you know, unprecedented roster makeup that Houston has this year, it's having the unprecedented elite route elite recruit in Jairus Walker, but it's also having an unprecedented returning veteran in Marcus Sasser. You know, Houston's had some guys come back, but I don't know that anyone has come back after being that NBA ready and just being that much of, you know, just like I said, in contention to be the best guard in the country the way that Marcus Sasser is. So I think really that's, it starts there. And then you mentioned Jamal Shedd, just absolutely the ideal Kelvin Sampson point guard, bulldog, coach on the court, tenacious defender, excellent ball handler, excellent distributor. Nice bonus, you know, finally looking more comfortable putting the ball in the basket, ended up averaging 10 points per game last year. But, you know, Jamal Shedd coming off the second most total assists in school history. You know, if he could be an even better player this year, and we've seen generally Houston players, especially Houston guards, have just gotten impossibly linearly better from year to year under this coaching staff. You know, I think he's a first team all conference player. So, you know, even getting into, you know, really, I think every guard on this roster deserves gushing over, but it's hard to gush enough and feel like you're doing justice to having a couple of guys coming back like Marcus Sasser and Jamal Shedd.
Dustin, you have a total of 7 scholarship guards in the roster right now. 4 of those guys have played significant minutes in this program. I would say two of them were varying degrees from borderline All-American to All-Conference caliber in that time. One was a previous Sun Belt Freshman of the Year, and the only 2 guys without any on-court divisional experience are national top 100 4-star freshmen. I mean, there's a case to be made for all 7 of these scholarship guards having a consistent role on this year's team, though I'm not necessarily predicting Kelvin Sampson will go 7 deep in his guard rotation. I don't think it's looking at this team in rose-tinted glasses to say, oh yeah, guys like Malik Wilson Manuel Sharp. I don't know why I wanted to call him Terrence Sharp there. That you don't have to squint too hard at Malik Wilson and Terrence. God, I keep calling him Emmanuel Sharp. He's not Terrence Arsenault. Emmanuel Sharp. Don't have to squint too hard at those guys and say, yeah, that guy would have had a really big role on a previous Cougar team and may just be crowded out because of how stacked this group is. It was a partial season sample size, but it's hard not to get really excited about what you saw from Marcus Sasser last year before he got hurt and maybe extrapolate that out a bit more with another year of development, another year of practicing, and that he has a good enough supporting cast that every opponent in your schedule isn't going to be able to just double Marcus Sasser, just zero in on Marcus Sasser and that being able to solve the Cougars offense. I mean, he made just under 44% of his 3-pointers in 12 games last year, was doing a better job getting to the free throw line at any point before the injury. And I think we were hoping to see him make some development last year and did see him become more than just a very good spot shooter, a guy who could drive, a guy who could distribute, a guy who really looked like he was on the verge of taking his game to a next level that we hadn't seen before the foot injury. I think it's exciting to see a continuation of that this year. And I think we started to see the staff realize in his last 6 or 7 games that, hey, we don't have to have Jamal Shedd be the backup Marcus Sasser. We can play Jamal Shedd and Marcus Sasser on the floor at the same time. Those guys' roles don't conflict. And again, an even smaller sample size than that Marcus Sasser partial season, you saw the Cougars just post some absurd numbers, both offensively and defensively, when you had both Shedd and Sasser in the starting lineup last year. I don't think I've even really touched on his improvement to being a truly fantastic on-ball defender as well. He's just the total package. There's a reason why he was the American Athletic Conference preseason player of the year, and that he's in that handful of guys who are getting extended run by everyone who covers the sport as one of the potential preseason players of the year. Though I think it'd be a mistake to give one guy credit on what was truly a team effort last year to overcome the Sasser and Mark injuries. But, you know, I don't know, Dustin, let's say Jamal Shedd gets thrust into a bigger role about 11 months ago, doesn't end up looking appreciably better than he did as a freshman. Last season's team accomplishments would be a lot more modest. I think so much of what happened last year depended on Jamal Shedd, and that's in no way to take away from guys like Edwards and Moore, who I think did a lot of heavy lifting, a lot more heavy lifting than they were expected to do in the preseason with Mark and Sasser out. I don't know. I'm not worried about any dynamic, you know, about who's running the offense, because I think we were already starting to see Shedd and Sasser figuring out how to play with each other. But that's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch, I think, whether those guys pick up where they left off in terms of this team really looking like a unstoppable force at times last year when you had both those guys on the floor.
Yeah, and certainly looking at some of the other returning guards that you're going to throw into that mix as well. You know, it's easy to forget Tremont Mark was one of the elite recruits of the Kelvin Sampson era, or still is, you know, really prior to Jairus Walker and Terrence Arsenault this year. He was a top-rated guy that the staff had brought in, and he spent 2 years in the program now. Neither season was he able to stay healthy. Freshman season got hurt by a case of COVID that really slowed him down, and then obviously last year needed the shoulder surgery, missed all of conference play. So, you know, someone who, you know, when he's right, extremely good at getting downhill, either scoring, getting to the bucket, or creating for his teammates. You know, in his limited time last year, had the highest assist rate on the team outside of Shed. So he's someone that I'm just beyond excited to have coming back. And then another guy who, you know, in a regular Cougar season in recent memory would have been an unquestioned starter heading into the season. And instead you go, well, I guess he's got to come off the bench. And that's Ramon Walker Jr., a guy who was, you know, supposed to redshirt last year, but was incredibly impressive when called upon. The only real knock was that he struggled shooting the three, and that I think had a lot to do with coming off of that wrist surgery. And, you know, Kelvin Sampson recently said he still wouldn't pick Ramon Walker to win a game of horse, but he'd pick Walker first in terms of impact winning. And, you know, he famously led the team in terms of taking charges last year, strong rebounding guard, guy who dives to the court to, you know, win the game at Wichita last year. So, you know, in terms of Mark and Walker, you know, even if you didn't have the two superstar studs ahead of them, you'd think, man, these are two guys who you really feel good about, you know, building your guard rotation around this year. And as it is, there may be your third and fourth guards or something. It's hard to know how they both fit in, other than that they're such incredibly talented players that impact winning in so many ways that, you know, Kelvin Sampson is going to find a way to get them involved.
I really love, I was going to mention that Kelvin Sampson quote about he wouldn't pick Ramon Walker first for horse, but he'd pick him first if he wanted to win a basketball game. Kelvin Sampson is a coach full of great quotes, but that's been one of my favorite of the last couple weeks. And another guy, I think, like you said, would have been mentioned a lot sooner in this preview were it not for the absurd talent experience that you have with this group of guys. Like Shed, I think a guy who really benefited from having to play a much bigger role than maybe we would have anticipated in the preseason last year. I think we said it a lot, but everything Walker did from a season ago should have that heavy context that the staff had seriously considered giving him an injury redshirt because of that wrist injury he suffered immediately before the season. I mean, you saw it in his offensive numbers, which on paper wouldn't really jump out to you, really weren't much to write home about, but was the quintessential energy guy, the quintessential glue guy. There was that great hustle play he made down the stretch in that wild overtime win at Wichita State. Countless other maybe less prominent times, he dived for a loose ball, tipped an opponent's pass, was in the exact right spot to draw a charge, or just did something that maybe can't be as easily quantified in a box score. Even with some of those unavoidable things hampering what he could do out there physically, certainly in terms of his offensive game, I thought last year his game reminded me so much of Nate Hinton. The court intelligence, the effort, the intangibles. I don't think I'm making that compliment too hastily. I thought he was a really smart basketball player. And I think, to cover something you mentioned a moment ago, I'm really excited about the unknown that is Tremont Mark. He's a guy who could be a playmaker with the ball in his hands. You could tell last year just never really looked fully healthy. I don't think we were really that surprised when they shut him down for the season, but the really good news there is he's been healthy for a while, didn't miss any of the team's offseason activities, and we haven't seen him do it this level as consistently as Sasser or Mark. Again, Sasser or Shed, by no fault of Tremont Mark, but I think what we've seen from the guy's been tantalizing, the length, the athleticism on both ends of the floor, the size to get to the basket and draw contact in a way that I just don't think Sasser or Shed will ever have the physical toolkit to do. And I know this is me somewhat going out on a limb here, but I would say barring some unforeseen injury, I think this could be Tremont Mark's last year of college basketball. And I think if it is, that'll be fantastic news for Cougar fans, because even in a stacked backcourt, that means he played so well that he, you know, was a good, fully healthy player on a national championship contending team. Also a strong testament to this position group, Dustin. We've gone this long and have not mentioned, other than in passing at the beginning, Terrence Arsenault, a consensus four-star recruit, the 247 Sports composite number 40 player in the class of 2022, led his Beaumont United High School team to back-to-back Texas 5A state championships. Anyone who's spent any amount of time covering or writing about him has just talked about what a good fit he is for the Houston Cougar program culture, how it seems like a lot of people expect by the end of this season he'll be playing a critical role with regards to this team's, you know, big goal of making a deep tournament run. And I've even seen the idea float to Dustin of Arsenault playing as a small ball four, and I'd really like that, because I think you need to be creative with getting a guy as versatile as Arsenault on the court. And I also would say Kelvin Sampson hasn't shown himself to be super rigid when it comes to trying different position groupings, trying to get guys on the floor. I guess, putting it another way, you'd like to find a way to get Arsenal on the floor at the same time as your top three guard grouping, wouldn't you?
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely worthwhile exploring different ways to get him on the floor. You know, someone who, if it wasn't for Jairus Walker, this would be the highest recruit in recent Houston history. And, you know, it's you know, kind of wild that, you know, we're only talking about him as maybe the fifth guard, which is why I think why it behooves you to pursue other options. And he's someone that, you know, 6'5", you know, long-armed, someone who is hailed as a havoc creator. So, you know, I'm excited to see what the staff does with him. I'm really excited to see him play, and someone who I think, as much as he can contribute offensively, I'm most excited to see what he can do on the defensive end, because you can just tell he's going to have some highlight reel plays this year, maybe most especially on the defensive end. And then another guy who, you know, in a less insanely stacked Houston team, we'd be talking about a lot higher, Emmanuel Sharp, someone who was, you know, came to Houston right off of an injury for his redshirt season last year, and then apparently dealing with like a calf sprain and a thumb sprain recently. So hopefully he's able to get fully healthy. But, you know, he's someone that Alan Bishop has raved about. He's really remade his body since arriving to campus in the middle of the previous season. And, you know, Samson's talked about him as being a really good scorer and passer. It's really exciting top 100 level prospect. And like I said, commentary on Houston's ridiculous guard depth that I think he might even have to wait another year until he gets major rotation minutes, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if he forces his way into the rotation already this year. And then, you know, the seventh guy here, Malik Wilson, you know, he's your quote-unquote seventh guard maybe, and is someone who's on his third school, was a double-digit scorer as a freshman and again as a sophomore for Louisiana Lafayette, but transferred to a really good Texas Tech team last year, played 15 minutes per game as part of their rotation. So, you know, didn't put up big numbers, but he's a good distributor, downhill type guy offensively, someone who would have been number one in steal rate and number two in block rate for a good Texas Tech team last year had he played enough minutes to qualify. So you add someone like that who's, you know, good enough to play significant rotation minutes at well, it was a really solid Tech team last year. He transfers to Houston. You don't expect him to do that, to just sit on the end of the bench all season. So absolute ridiculous embarrassment of riches when you look at this Houston guard group.
In numerous previous Cougar men's basketball seasons, we would be talking about both those guys, Sharp and Wilson, playing a much, much bigger role than I think they'll be able to play this year. And that's not to be, you know, saying these two should or will be nailed to the bench. And Kelvin Sampson, I think, has shown the ability over his time here to expand and contract his rotation as needed. I think it's really hard to find consistent minutes for seven different guards.
Yeah, and then as we look at this this forward group, you know, they're not going to get as much heralding as the guard group, but definitely a group that I am still just beyond excited about. And, you know, a couple guys got to talk about right up front. You know, Jawan Roberts, man, I absolutely love him as a player. Unreal rebounder, someone who can defend, I think, the four or the five. He's just an absolute major pest in that monster defense that Houston runs. You know, you don't even really need him to score any points, and he probably won't be a double-figure scorer, but, you know, he's someone who I think has looked surprisingly comfortable with the ball at times for someone who only really put up shots when they were layups and putbacks. So I think we may see a little bit more extension of his offensive game, but man, even if not, this dude is an absolute force of nature, one that I'm incredibly glad plays for us and not someone else on our schedule. And I'm just beyond excited about the idea of seeing monster doubling post defense with a couple of unbelievable athletes like Jawan Roberts and Jairus Walker, who I think, you know, they're maybe both more natural fours, but I think they can play them together because of, you know, how good they're both going to be defensively and how active they are both defensively. Obviously, not every day you see Houston bring in the best high school basketball player at his position in the country, and it's not every time that a player of Jairus Walker's quality even ends up playing college basketball, period. An absolute physical specimen, freak athlete, someone who, you know, has already prided himself on hitting the glass before joining a Houston program where doing that is very much mandatory. And, you know, I think the fact that Kelvin Sampson has said that Walker is running with the first team now, you know, when you've got a forward who brings everything that Wani has proven to bring you, and you've got a guy like Reggie Chaney, who was a starter on a Final Four team, the fact that you got Walker running with the ones is a pretty big endorsement that, yeah, this guy is going to be really, really exciting. So, you know, I have no doubt that Jairus is primarily concerned with helping the Cougs win this year, but I know he's someone who has his sights set on being a first-round NBA draft pick a year from now. And kind of like you mentioned with, you know, Tremont Mark, and hoping that he's playing professionally a year from now, I hope Jairus Walker is a first-year draft pick a year from now, because that means that, you know, Houston only had him for a season, but that means that for that one season he was good enough to, you know, warrant being a one-and-done. So, sounds like it's going to be an awfully fun season to watch as a fan. And as much as we can talk about this, maybe the best guard group in that country, man, the idea of Wani Roberts and Jairus Walker running the front court together, it's just, those guys are going to be so mean and so much fun to watch and just make some crazy, ridiculous plays and just embarrass some opponents this year.
And for all that unbelievable talent, I think we got just done talking about at guard. What really, I think, is going to differentiate this team from even the very, very good Cougar teams of the recent past, I think it's this front court. And last year really demonstrated how much progress the staff has made in terms of bringing in big men who could shoulder more of the scoring load if need be. And as important as the contributions of guys like Jamal Shedd, Kyler Edwards, and Tajay Moore were to last year's team, if you go and replace Fabian White Jr. and Josh Carlton with just two average replacement level big men, I don't know if this is a 30-plus win team that goes to the Elite Eight and won both available conference championships. Those guys last year were easily the best front court pairing that Cougar men's basketball has had under Kelvin Sampson. And I think I should preface the excitement we have for this group, and we've got a lot of it, by pointing out that you are losing the winningest player in program history and a fifth-year senior who was first-team all-conference. Those are big shoes to fill. But I think it's also easier to feel optimistic that despite those losses, you are returning two veteran big men with multiple years in this program, Reggie Chaney and Jaywan Roberts. You're bringing in the highest rated incoming freshman in this program's recruiting rankings era. And I think a wild card second year big man who people around the program seem to think is going to be eventually poised for a much bigger role in the coming seasons. I'm really curious to see who the starting five most often ends up being in conference play, especially when it comes to the center position. I think you can make a good case for either Reggie Chaney or Jaywan Roberts. I think it's everything you said about Jaywan Roberts, I completely co-sign with. He's just an unbelievable offensive rebounder. He's a guy who seems almost tailor-made to do the things Kelvin Sampson wants a big man to do, and that he's a great athlete, he's a great rebounder, a hard worker, and isn't going to demand to be a part of the offense a lot, which I think with a team like this one, it's going to have three or four very skilled offensive players on the floor at any one given time, that you don't want Jaywan Roberts to be demanding the ball a bunch when you have Marcus Sasser and Tremont Mark potentially on the floor at the same time. But again, I think it's worth reminding, don't forget Reggie Chaney was your starting five down the stretch at the end of that Final Four season. And just anytime Kelvin Sampson talks about him on the record, he raves about him, how selfless he is, how much he does the unflashy, dirty work that you want your big men to do. And Reggie Chaney is also a good offensive rebounder. He had the second most offensive boards 2 seasons ago, despite only averaging 14 minutes per game. He's an efficient scorer, shot over 65% in that Final Four season. And like Robert, somebody who's not going to demand a ton of the ball in a starting lineup with a number of guys who are going to be go-to offensive players. I think you could repeat all those positives about Chaney for Roberts, but I think Roberts does have a bit of a higher ceiling in terms of his offensive rebounding ability, in terms of the big man skill set. And you know, one of those awesome individual performances that I try not to overlook, because it was a really fantastic one in a losing effort last season. Remember when Wani Roberts had 9 offensive rebounds against Bama? Yeah. That was incredible. That almost single-handedly kept the Cougars in the game. It was a wild game for Wani, because he also went 1 for 6 from the free throw line, but you're also probably not in that game if he's not grabbing just about every available offensive rebound. I think Chaney has a bit more offensive polish, but I think if I'm predicting it, Roberts is your night one starter opposite of Jairus Walker in the front court against Northern Colorado.
Yeah, I like Chaney a lot as well. Someone who, you know, maybe doesn't get mentioned enough just because he doesn't do the flashy things, but, you know, just absolute, you know, junkyard dog kind of player, hard-nosed defender and rebounder. Like you said, really fits the mold of a Kelvin Sampson player, someone who would have been a top 100 shot blocker last year if he had enough minutes to be eligible. So someone who, you know, because he doesn't have that elite size, doesn't jump out in terms of his shot blocking, but I think someone who you know, has good timing in the post and blocks more shots than people maybe realize. And then you kind of alluded to it, JVA Francis, some guy who a guy who did not really play significant minutes in games last year. But, you know, really came on at the end of games and did some really eye-popping things with what he can do athletically. You feel like there's a really, really high ceiling there. And, you know, you've seen the staff pretty consistently favor a four-man forward rotation. So, you know, unless they are going to use, you know, Arsenal regularly as a small ball four, then that means that JVA Francis, I think, is the next most likely guy to step up and be part of that forward rotation. So would definitely be a big step up for him. But I'm very excited about the possibility that he might be actually ready to play a bigger role, because like you said, it's someone who I think in the long term has a lot of potential.
And you try to temper your expectations for someone like Jairus Walker. You realize even for the highest level recruits, there is a learning curve going from high school basketball to Division I game. But it's kind of challenging to temper your expectations when that guy is your highest ever rated recruit, at least in this era, consensus five-star McDonald's All-American. No matter the recruiting service, one of the 10 or 11 best high school prospects in his graduating class. And I know every coach of every program that brings in a high-level recruit is going to say the same lines about how nobody gets special treatment, everyone has to earn their minutes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're certainly not going to say any different publicly. I do think there's enough of a track record here around Kelvin Sampson that he's not going to let Jairus Walker, or for that matter, Terrence Arsenault, Emmanuel Sharp, or any high-level recruit come in here and get special treatment in a program that I think prides itself on being tough in any measurable way. Really exciting player, Walker. He's a better ball handler, the book on him, than your average big man, a ferocious rebounder. Like you said, I'm really excited to see monster double teams that feature some combination of Wani Roberts, Reggie Chaney, and Jairus Walker. He sounds like the kind of big man who can also, despite being a skilled offensive player, still handle playing alongside high-usage teammates like Marcus Sass or Tremont Mark and others this season. I think that kind of goes nature of the beast, playing for an elite program like the IMG Academy, playing with three or four other high-level recruits at any given time in the starting lineup. I mean, just like you said earlier, Walker's a different level than anyone we've had come through this program, certainly any big man that's come through this program. And somebody, I think it's important, didn't seem to come in here because he thought he would get the star treatment. He clearly, from his public comments, from what Sampson has said, wants his, likely pretty short, college career to be in a program that will make him a better player and challenge him and also be on a team capable of making a deep tournament run. And I think with JVA Francis, the only thing I would add is that I don't know why Kieran Powell transferred before this season, but you'd have to think at least was somewhat an indication of what the staff thought of JVA Francis. And Powell, I think, understandably, not wanting to sit behind a guy as a guy who's a Division I ready big man, not wanting to sit another year behind someone who's maybe a year younger than him. I feel like I'm talking about Francis the same way that maybe you or I talked about Wani Roberts, a season or two in the program. Also worth noting that Francis played pretty sparingly last year. Roberts did not play at all his first season in the program. So I'd have to imagine the staff is kind of looking at a similar development timetable with Francis long-term behind, I think, some pretty established talented guys in the front of the front court rotation.
And then the last front court guy, last scholarship player we haven't mentioned, Darius Bowser, the fifth-year senior Charleston Southern transfer. Doesn't figure to be a big part of the rotation. Was a starter on a really bad Charleston Southern team the last couple of years. Has shown some good rebounding numbers, and the Cougs did have a free scholarship to add some depth in the front court, so I think it makes sense that they did that. But, you know, if I had to guess, I think he looks like the fifth out of five options in the front court. But, you know, maybe one injury away from getting some rotation minutes and having an experienced guy who is not going to try to do too much, I think, is a good thing to have. So, yeah, just overall looking at this roster, Sam, it's hard to pick holes in terms of, you know, things that Houston is not going to be able to do well and or positions that they don't have, both high-level talent and pretty exciting depth. It seems like it's a roster that's going to be able to even withstand some wear and tear and some dings and maybe some guys missing some games. So obviously don't wish that on anybody, but this feels like a Houston team that, like I said, very hard as you look up and down this roster, very hard to figure out what the other weaknesses would be, and intimidating to imagine being an opposing coach trying to figure out how to game plan against a team that has just so many ways to beat you.
We've had deep teams here under Kelvin Sampson. We've had teams with that featured a couple of guards who were formerly very high-level recruits. You want to go back a couple years. Dejan Giroux and Quentin Grimes were both top 60 recruits in their respective graduating class. I don't know if we've had the combination of frontline talent and depth that this year's team featured. I think why it's so easy to talk yourself into this team being a Final Four team, that this team is one of the handful that you can make a case for being the preseason number one or a betting odds favorite to make the Final Four, things like that. There's a reason why this program that's been respected for a while, that's had high expectations around for a while, I think has such uniquely high expectations both internally and externally for the season.
And looking at the schedule that Houston has, you know, I think non-conference, really only four games that Houston would have any business, you know, really losing or being in a competitive game. They're at Oregon. They face St. Mary's in Fort Worth. They have Alabama at home and Virginia away. And, you know, a couple of those games that I want to highlight that I'm really intrigued by, the Oregon and Virginia games, two teams that Houston last year stomped pretty badly, Oregon at a neutral site, Virginia at the Fertitta Center. And then both of those, you know, programs, I think, had surprisingly down years at the end of the year, where Houston stomping them was maybe not just indicative of that Houston played really well in those games and deserved the wins, but also that those teams were having kind of unexpected down years. But I think both programs are expected to widely expected to have bounce back seasons this year. Ken Pom loves Virginia in particular, actually sees the Hoos as the fifth best team in the country heading into the year. So, you know, some exciting highlights to the non-conference schedule. Wouldn't have hated seeing maybe one more marquee opponent. It sounded like Kelvin Sampson kind of wanted to get one more on there as well. Couldn't make it work. You don't always get the games that you want. Houston, you know, you'll be big favorites in the other nine non-conference games. You do get an Oral Roberts team that was tournament darlings a couple of years ago. Kent State won 23 games a year ago. But would be surprised if anybody seriously threatens Houston outside of those four. But in terms of marquee games at Oregon, St. Mary's and Fort Worth, Alabama at home, Virginia away, that looks like four games in non-conference that are going to be a lot of fun, each in their own right.
Yeah, maybe I agree with you. I think Kelvin Sampson, if you gave him truth serum, probably would have wanted one more quote-unquote marquee game in there, though. You know, worth noting, Kent State was one win away from the NCAA tournament last year. Oral Roberts made that deep run a couple seasons ago, and TSU is pretty regularly the SWAC representative in the postseason again. But I would agree with you that there are only really four games you have any business losing and it not being a huge upset. The trip to Oregon being the first, I think that'll be an interesting one. The Cougars, like you alluded to, beat the Ducks pretty badly at last year's Maui Invitational. Dana Altman did rework that roster a bit, bringing back a good amount of their core as well, though they did get the bad news that one of their big offseason arrivals, Jermaine Cousinard, certainly won't be healthy for the U of H game. I think it's going to be a push to be ready for the start of Pac-12 play. And that game against St. Mary's in DFW, St. Mary's, consistently quite a good program, really, with Gonzaga the only consistently good to, in Gonzaga's case, better than good programs in the West Coast Conference, one of the more consistent programs out there. As well, in that annual Dickies Arena game, the Cougars seem to play opening conference play right before the end of the year against Tulsa. And I don't know, maybe it's fatigue, but I was really struggling to find a lot of compelling games other than the Memphis game. I will say, you do have roadies in January that might be interesting against Cincy and Tulane, who both, in Tulane's case, could be taking the next step from good AAC team to maybe NIT, spinning distance of at-large kind of team with everyone back there. Cougars are going to play everyone home and away in league play, except for South Florida, who the Cougars will only host, and ECU, who the Cougars will only see via one more trip to Greenville. Not coincidentally, those two games against Memphis fairly backloaded. The Tigers come to Houston on the 19th of February, and the two teams play in Memphis, the FedEx Forum, for the regular season finale, with a conference tournament being held at Dickies Arena in Fort Worth. Am I not giving enough credit to the conference schedule, Dustin? Are you really excited about one more go around with Tulsa, one more matchup with the Temple Owls, one more trip to Koch Arena to take on the Wichita State Shockers?
Yeah, I'm not too excited. It looks like an American Athletic Conference that, in fairly classic AAC fashion, has, you know, probably one other team that looks like an NCAA at-large caliber team, but long on teams that are, you know, maybe you'd be generous to say they're not too far off. So, you know, I think it gets back to what I said. I think it's a conference full of teams that if Houston, you know, doesn't take them seriously or just kind of goes through, you know, sleepwalks through some of these games, I think there are some teams that could make Houston pay there, but you know, it's a lot of games that I think Houston is going to be heavily favored. And, you know, like I said, give Memphis some credit. We'll call them what looks like an NCAA at-large team. They were last year, went to the NCAA tournament. They won a game. They did bring in Kendrick Davis from across the conference and SMU, one of the most sought-after players in the transfer portal. They have 11th-year senior DeAndre Williams, who was a player that I think is a pretty solid AAC player. But, you know, I think some big questions there. You know, are we going to finally see a Penny Hardaway team actually take decent care of the ball? Will they still be able to play high-level defense? That's kind of been their calling card under Penny without a real elite rim protector like they've had. You know, Malcolm Dandridge is a big veteran body who can block some shots, but I don't think he's on the same level as guys like Jalen Duren and Musa Cisse. And then, you know, looking around the rest of the conference, there's, I think, of some players returning some interesting, you know, cores of players, you know, Cincinnati, David Julius, Jeremiah Davenport, Mike Adams Woods. You know, that team was it looked like they really just fell off a cliff at the end of last year, but they get those guys back. They add some impact transfers, including another intra-conference transfer, Landers Nolly from Memphis to Cincinnati. I think worth keeping an eye on them. Worth keeping an eye on Tulane, who returns that, you know, really impressive core of Jalen Cook, Jalen Forbes, Kevin Cross. I think they have an outside shot to reach the NCAA tournament for the first time this century, and just the fourth time ever in over 100 years of fielding a team. And then you crack on Temple, and that's understandable, but you know, I think this is a team that was actually surprised. Yeah. They were surprisingly competitive in the American last year. I think that was their first indication that Aaron McKee might have that thing pointed in the right direction. They get their big two back in terms of Khalif Battle and Damian Dung, among some other contributors there. But yeah, after that, I think it's hard to see too many other teams that really scare you much in any meaningful way. Wichita, someone you usually expect to field a competitive team, but hard to know what to make of them after they did a pretty hard reset of nearly the entire roster, bringing in transfers from all over. You know, UCF went 9-9 in AAC play last year, was their best conference record in 3 years since the team that made the NCAA tournament and almost upset Duke, but they lose a trio of double-digit scorers. I'm not real bullish on them. I think they're going to struggle this year. I think they're going to really struggle with the Big 12 transition. If I had to pick a team to finish last in the Big 12 next year, I'd pick UCF without having to think about it too hard. And then, you know, SMU bringing a new head coach, another pretty drastic roster overhaul, bringing in a bunch of transfers as they lose Kendrick Davis. So hard to see them being one of the better teams in the American. And then, you know, Tulsa, USF, ECU all looking non-competitive. So like I said, I think you have to kind of squint and hope to see some of these teams. I mean, obviously, Houston is going to be a team that wants to be in competition for a one seed at the end of the year. So you'd love to have a few games on your schedule that actually mean something. So hopefully we'll see at least a couple of these AAC teams go out and have really strong non-conference campaigns and actually, you know, pump the conference up a little bit. But not super optimistic, and it is nice to know, if nothing else, that this is the last year that we're going to rely on the American Athletic Conference to try to provide a helpful strength of schedule for the Cougs.
Yeah, it's a lot of teams kind of in that general 70 to 120 range in KenPom.
Right.
You know, good enough that with a mostly packed house, and I don't think it's us overstating how good this Cougar team is to say that you were going to get a packed house or just about a packed house for every conference road game you play this year. That is the level of opponent U of H is. It's kind of like, and I know we've been this team for at least a couple of years now, Dustin, but it's like going back to you and I's much younger days, to Memphis era John Calipari, and how you and I would be there for most home games, you and I and 13 or 14 of various friends and associates of ours. And then the Memphis game would happen and it'd be like, oh yeah, there's hundreds and thousands of more that could be attending these games but aren't, but you're here because we're playing the whatever rank Memphis was at that time. We are going to be that team now for the various underachieving programs of the American Athletic Conference, so I hope you all are ready for that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, kind of my closing thoughts here. We talked at the beginning about the crazy expectations around this team, and I think it's worthwhile to kind of stop and ask, you know, what are reasonable expectations, because it's hard to know what that is when the hype is just going to be so dramatic around this team. You know, look at, you know, you and I try to rely pretty heavily on KenPom when we're not sure what to think. KenPom, like I said, the only game that they have the Cougs as an underdog is the Virginia game in Charlottesville. But you know, nonetheless, through, you know, cumulative win probabilities, has Houston finishing 26-5 overall, 15-3 in the American. No, 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 just, and again, it makes me feel like maybe I'm getting caught up in too much of the hype, that I feel like 26-5, 15-3 would be a little bit of a disappointment. I don't know if that gets Houston the one or two seed that they're going to want heading into the NCAA tournament with that strength of schedule. It kind of depends on what everyone else ends up doing. But yeah, this is just a season where, like I said, you have probably four marquee games in non-conference, you know, a handful, maybe if you're lucky, of marquee games in conference play. So this is just really not a Houston team that we expect to be in a whole lot of competitive games. I expect to see a lot of, 20-plus point Houston wins this year. But it's hard to know exactly, what's that going to mean in terms of overall wins and losses heading into the season. And, it's hard to believe that Houston is there, but we're at the point where the expectations are not just having a good regular season. It's doing that and then making a deep run in the NCAA tournament. So, all I think you can say is just encourage everyone to take it a game at a time. Last year's team, really good team. Almost lost to Hofstra in the season opener. A couple of years ago, we've had some other games, against teams that ended up being really good that, had some near misses and some losses against some kind of head-scratching teams. So I think it is worth reminding everyone to take a step back and not completely freak out and overreact to an individual loss here or there. But, I think you can say that, and maybe I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth because I say that, but at the same time, yeah, I expect this team to be winning, high 20s, if not low 30s number of games and make a late NCAA tournament run. But that's just because you have a head coach and a coaching staff that has made expectations, has so successfully exceeded expectations that it's hard to see this team being anything less than an absolute juggernaut this season.
Yeah, echo most of what you said there. This is going to be a very good team. This is a team that you should expect to win both available conference championships and make a deep NCAA tournament run. But also worth remembering, the NCAA tournament, very volatile. You see lots of upsets. That's why there's the madness after March Madness. Guaranteeing a spot in the Final Four is very difficult, though I think this is one of those handful of teams that you can look at and say, yeah, you can make a good case for them being one of the last handful standing in the sport. And also, just remember that the basketball season is more of a marathon than the sprint. Kind of rewire your brain from football season where, at least to some fans, every loss is this big deal. I mean, if we lose to Virginia and Charlottesville, it's not the end of the world. You don't need to add us about how this team's failing to meet expectations. It's even the very best teams in the country quite often lose somewhere between 4 to 6 regular season games. It happens. This team is almost certainly not going to go through the schedule this season unblemished. If anything, Kelvin Sampson's teams off a loss are a very, very fearsome team. But this team should win nearly all of its games, should make a deep NCAA tournament run, and I think definitely has earned the high expectations around them. And well, Dustin, to do my one and only probable transition of this podcast, we'll get a chance to start proving their worth, those expectations, on Monday night at the Fertitta Center, will they not?
That's right. They'll be hosting Northern Colorado to open the season on Monday evening. The Bears went 22-16 a year ago, finishing tied for third in the Big Sky Conference. They're picked to finish third again this year. A really strong offensive team last year, top 30 nationally in per game point scoring, but they just couldn't guard much of anybody, and they weren't a great rebounding team either. They do return a couple of big time scorers and 6'4 guard Dalen Kuntz, who scored over 21 points per game last year. He and 6'2 guard Matt Johnson, who scored a little over 13 points a game, both used their fifth year COVID year to come back this season, but they do lose a bunch of contributors behind those two. So I think open question who picks up the scoring slack. Their only D1 transfer was actually Rice grad transfer Riley Abercrombie, not someone who looks like a major impact guy. So, like I said, game that Houston should win, but I think it's a little bit scary in that they profile kind of similarly to last year's opener in Hofstra, a team that, like I said, had a diminutive guard who scored a bunch of points in Zach Cooks. They actually nearly beat Houston to open the season in the Fertitta Center. The Cougs ended up prevailing in overtime. So, not to say I'm writing Northern Colorado off entirely, but it is a game that you feel like if Houston brings their A or at least their B game that they're going to probably be fine.
I'm glad you and I are of similar minds, because I kind of took a look at this Northern Colorado team and thought maybe it's just me remembering them as a team that darn near beat the Cougars, but seeing a team that good offensively, maybe a bit challenged in the previous year defensively, but with some experienced guards who can go nuclear in a big game, maybe worries you a little bit. This was a team that was top 20 nationally in both 2-point and 3-point field goal percentage last year with a couple of veteran guards. I think fair to say they're going to immediately test your perimeter ability, though at the same time, it's really hard to see how they're going to stop a team with as much offensive skill as these Cougars have. But I mean, it's a team that projects to potentially have up to 80% of their lineup be guys who are fourth or fifth year collegiate players. So you at least give the respect that this is a team full of guys who've played a lot of college basketball. If they get hot, maybe they can make things uncomfortable the same way Hofstra did in last year's opener.
All right, and then I think that's what we'll go ahead and leave it for the men's team. But we do want to talk about some Cougar women's basketball here heading into the season as well. Also starting the season on Monday, the Cougs were famously, or maybe infamously, the first team out of the NCAA tournament 2 years ago. And with the amount of returning players they had last year, we thought this was going to be the year that Houston finally broke through back into the NCAA postseason. But the Cougars struggled, especially offensively and especially early on in conference play, and even a strong finish to the season only got the Cougs to an 18-16 overall record, 77 in the final net rankings, not an NCAA tournament consideration. So, you know, Ron Huey enters year 8 at the helm now, and I think with their amount of returning talent, I think once again this looks like a team that profiles like one that could break Houston's NCAA tournament drought. But, you know, I think it's got to be a fairly warm seat under Coach Huey at this point, someone who I think we both agree has been an unbelievable ambassador for the university, someone who has, you know, had some really strong teams, and but, you know, entering year 8 and still waiting for that team that finally gets over the hump and gets Houston back to the NCAA tournament. I think there's a lot of reasons to be excited about this year's team, a lot of players coming back. But at the same time, like I said, you felt that way before, and definitely a warm seat year for the Houston Cougar women's basketball program.
I would agree. I will say this team did play better ball down the stretch last year, including the conference tournament. The Cougs went 7-4 for the months of February and March, did go on a WNIT run after that, which ended in the Sweet 16 on the road to Bama. And one of the real bugaboos of last season, besides a really poor January, was just really looking second best against the Florida schools, UCF and USF, the two NCAA tournament representatives of this conference. And that good stretch I just mentioned did also feature a 33-point loss in Tampa against the Bulls to close the regular season, and an 8-point loss in the AAC tournament to that same USF team that really wasn't ever that competitive. Cougs did come heartbreakingly close to beating UCF in Orlando and actually led after three quarters against the Knights in Houston, but ended up losing that one by 10. But you return the top five scorers off last year's team, and for their flaws as a team, if you do look at the numbers last year, this might have been Ronald Huey's best defensive team since arriving at the University of Houston. Only allowed 61 points a game, top 40 nationally in steals per game, led the American in block shots and opponent turnovers per game, held opponents to under 40% shooting from the field for the season. The problem, though, is U of H's team offensive numbers weren't much better, and you only had one player average in double-figure scoring, Layla Blair. So all that returning production is good news, though I think that good news is tempered by the clear and obvious need for this team, I guess outside of Layla Blair, to really improve on the offensive end and to really match what was, I think, for the most part, a season of playing pretty well on the defensive end last year.
Yeah, I agree. It's a team that defensively I thought looked good, but has a long way to go offensively in terms of becoming a more efficient team. And, you know, looking at the roster, you know, you mentioned Layla Blair, and she certainly highlights your a trio of returning guards. Layla Blair, Brittany Onyedje, Tierra Young give Houston three, you know, pretty significant contributors in the backcourt who are back this year. And, you know, Blair, certainly the name that leads the conversation, someone who went from exciting freshman 2 years ago to second team all AAC last year. And, you know, if Houston is going to get over the hump to the NCAA tournament this year, I think it's going to be because Layla Blair had her best year yet, and she, you know, she's got so much scoring potential. She's improved so much in her overall game from the beginning of her freshman season to the end of last season. But, you know, I would say even Blair, I think, is a player who you need to see improvement from offensively. In terms of her efficiency, I don't think your best player is someone that you want to have shooting under 35% from the floor. So I think that even there, there is room for her to improve. But her overall game has improved so much. You know, I feel like, you know, she is the clear leader of this team at this point, and someone that you feel like is going to have worked on her game so much in the offseason that we're going to see improvement from her leading the way. And like I said, it's a guard group that as a whole needs to get, you know, I think the team as a whole, but especially this guard group, needs to get more efficient putting the ball in the bucket. You know, Onyedje, another really exciting returning veteran, someone who can really shoot it from the outside, high scoring potential, but another player who I think needs to help the Cougs by, you know, shooting better than 35% from the field going forward. So behooves this guard group and this team as a whole to, you know, not just rest on their laurels from some of the exciting things that they did last season, but really find a way to find another gear heading into this year.
Yeah, I think what's so exciting about Blair, even acknowledging, like you said, and I agree, that your top usage guard should probably be a bit more efficient from the field, or you'd like that to be the case if you are going to improve offensively this year, but can score at all levels, is reliable at the charity stripe, and I think did well despite maybe being asked to play the point guard a bit more than she did her first year of college basketball. And worth noting, I think Huey did bring in Demyla Brown, a veteran transfer from Illinois, who played the point guard for the Illini, which I think is good first and foremost because you can never have enough experienced players who can run the point. But I think it also frees Blair to play a bit more off ball, where I think she could be lethal. Anjay, like you said, back for her fifth year, should be in the game one lineup after starting 51 the last two seasons. Did see a small drop in her scoring average last year, but actually saw a slight improvement across the board in most of the offensive numbers, while also being a plus defender. If she could take another step forward this year, I think she'll definitely be in the all-conference consideration, just given what she brings on the defensive end and given how she can, I think, really, if you could consistently get a bit more from Blair and Anjay and a bit more from the supporting cast, like Tierra Young, for example, who averaged 21 minutes off the bench last year, had some big performances down the stretch. Young was really good in wins over Tulane in the AAC tournament and in the Cougs' first-round WNIT win on the road over La Tech. I think Young probably has the best chance to start on the opener against Ooh La La alongside Blair and Anjay, though I wouldn't also be shocked if the guard I just mentioned, Demyla Brown, starts at point and allows Blair to play off ball. Worth mentioning, Brown averaged just over 8 points per game last year at Illinois, led the Illini in steals, was a first-team junior college All-American at Chipola the year before that. I'm not exactly sure how the NCAA is treating players who played the JUCO season during that COVID year, but I would think Brown potentially also has one more year to play after this one if she wants it. And that's really it for guards who have significant Division I experience. You have a foursome of returning guards who played sparingly last year: Kendall Brown, Taylor Purvis, Asia Thompson, and Celia Burrell. A couple transfers who didn't play a whole ton at their last school: Amari Khan and Kiara Sanderlin, and freshman Tara Johnson from San Diego. I guess you'd probably figure that one or two of that group will see a bigger role than they have prior in their career behind the four guards that I've just mentioned.
Yeah, you mentioned Tara Young, someone who I think was really exciting when she got downhill to the basket last year, but you know, the three-point shooting pretty bad, needs to either just abandon the three-point shot entirely or have improved that in the offseason. You mentioned Demyla Brown, who I think is going to be a big part of this rotation as well. But yeah, I mean, Coach Huey is someone who likes to, you know, run full court pressure, likes to, you know, ask a lot of his players and rotate freely. And we saw, you know, a six guard rotation last year with the three returners we mentioned: Blair, Anjay, and Young, but also, you know, Julia Blackshell, Farrah Diamond Gladney, Erica Sidney, three guards that saw a fair amount of playing time that are no longer on the roster. So, you know, other than Brown coming in, I think, like you said, it's a very big open question in terms of who else is ready to step up and be part of that guard rotation, because Coach Huey probably not going to only play those four guards serious minutes. He's going to want to have a couple players that he can run out there at the guard spots. And I think it is going to be real interesting. And I think it's very important for Houston's overall, you know, season that they have, to not only get the improved seasons from the players that are coming back with a significant amount of D1 experience, who you do expect to play significant minutes, but also, you know, figuring out who else can step up and play a bigger role. And then, you know, looking at the forward group, you know, Houston gets back its starters and fifth-year senior Tatiana Hill and senior power forward Bria Patterson. Really excited to get Patterson back. You know, big X factor, does so many things well. Missed a handful of games last year, and I think you could really tell the difference when she was out that Houston struggled in her absence. And then, of course, Hill at the five, you know, Houston's best returning rebounder and shot blocker. She kind of fell off offensively towards the end of last year. I'd love to see her, you know, more regularly getting into double digits this year. So, you know, a couple of interesting backup as well that we can talk about, Sam, but I think right away you love getting back your starting front court in Bria Patterson and Tatiana Hill again.
You really do, and you can't single out any one thing for the team's really poor January, but like you said, I think Bria Patterson missing part of that month injured certainly didn't help. She's the kind of front court player who can stretch opposing defenses, is active defensively, and I think like Anjay, she takes a step forward, it'll at least get her in the all-conference discussion. And you'll likely see Tatiana Hill starting alongside her at the five. Hill led the team in block shots and rebounds a year ago. It does still feel like she's chasing, you know, that really impressive sophomore season she had in 2019-2020, where she averaged a hair under 11 points and 6.5 rebounds per game. Did have career highs last year in offensive rebounds and block shots by pretty wide margin in the block shots. Just because of the nature of her game, though, Hill draws a lot of contact and goes to the free throw line a fair amount. And I'm kind of hoping for her to have a Chris Harris senior year, kind of improvement the charity stripe. And I'm not talking about Hill becoming an 85-90% free throw shooter. Maybe let's just say somewhere around 60-65% on freebies. I think that could make a really, really big difference in her game. Cameron Jones is the only other front court player with significant experience in this roster who's back. And even though her numbers don't scream at you, I think Huey and the staff like her a lot. I expect she'll see a similar increase in minutes this year that she saw from her first year to last season, where her minutes per game almost doubled, or her per minute numbers, kind of like Tatiana Hill, are exciting. And with her first year on campus being the COVID season, it's exciting to think about her potentially having three more years to develop, and maybe next season after Hill's graduating, really fully coming into her own in the front court. Someone else who's really intriguing the staff this offseason brought in 6'3 forward Logan McNeil. She redshirted last year at LSU while recovering from a preseason ACL tear. Be curious how much the staff is willing to give the front court minutes to her first Division One action and coming off a major injury, but clearly it was a good high school recruit and somebody the staff thinks could be quite good long-term.
Yeah, I also have liked Cameron Jones a lot, someone who looks like the prototypical needs a redshirt year or two forward a couple of years ago when she came in, but has really shown an increasing ability over the last two seasons to make plays, someone who's not afraid of contact, someone who gets her hand on a lot of balls and is a high IQ player. And like you said, I think the newcomer that I'm most intrigued by is Logan McNeil, just for that elite high school pedigree that she had, and certainly hoping that the ACL is fully healed, because if so, you know, that's the type of recruit that you don't get at Houston necessarily the first time around. So if you get her as a redshirt freshman, if she's, you know, showing you know, why she was such a highly touted recruit in the first place, then certainly that's someone you feel like could force her way into the the forward rotation. As we look at this the schedule and the AAC slate ahead of Houston, it's a very intriguing non-conference schedule. You've got a quartet of teams kind of in the 20-win top 100 net mid-major range in New Mexico, Portland, UT, Arlington, and Middle Tennessee State. You've got a quartet of good but not unbeatable P5 foes in Florida State, Florida, Kansas State, and Washington State. And then five games that I'd say that Houston probably should win to varying degrees in Louisiana, Lafayette, newly minted D1 school, Texas A&M Commerce, UMBC, Rice, and UTSA. And then in, you know, in the AAC, last year there was a clear power structure of, you know, UCF, then USF, then Tulane, then everybody else. This year there's major turnover at all three of those teams, especially UCF, who was actually picked eighth in the American preseason poll after losing their head coach and much of their team via the transfer portal to Georgia. Tulane loses most of their team, picked to finish fifth. South Florida does return a big 1-2 punch in guard Elena Cheneke and forward Dulcie Foncom Mengiadu, which I think makes them the rightful AAC favorites, but there's a lot of questions to answer and shoes to fill outside of those two. So Cougs picked a comfortable second in the preseason AAC poll, well ahead of SMU and Tulsa in the 3-4 spots. So definitely high expectations, but a wide open AAC that Houston should do well in. And frankly, Sam, it's a wide open non-conference schedule where you feel like there's a lot of variation where, you know, I think it's possible this team is, you know, 500-ish heading into conference play, and they've kind of already played themselves out of, NCAA tournament consideration. And I think it's entirely possible that this is a team that only has, one or two losses heading into non-conference play, and at that point would have built up a pretty good start to the season and be doing pretty well in the net rankings. So very, very, I think, variable schedule ahead of Houston, and I think one that's going to be hard to predict.
Yeah, as usual, Coach Huey scheduled enough good opponents that strength of schedule won't be an issue. I think the challenge is, kind of like you were just saying, is to snag a couple of those signature non-conference wins to make up for the fact that you're not really going to get a lot of respect from the post-UConn AAC. Even if you can repeat two seasons ago and have a good conference record, it's not guaranteed that that good conference record is going to get your postseason resume over the line. And that challenge is twofold: getting a signature win or two from that tough non-conference slate, and also not taking a really damaging loss from one of the bottom half of the AAC teams in league play. I think this will be one of the top two teams in this league when it's all said and done. UCF, who's been pretty better than the Cougs the last several seasons, is starting from scratch with their coach leaving for Georgia. And I really would put this team ahead of everyone not named South Florida in this league. I'm not sure I'm ready right now to predict this team will break that NCAA tournament drought, but the schedule is there to do it. The returning talent's there to do it. We just gotta actually see them do it.
So the Cougs will get the first chance to face a D1 opponent when they host, or when they not host, but rather travel to Lafayette to take on the Raging Cajuns in the season opener on Monday. UL Lafayette went 15-7 against D1 competition a year ago, finishing 9-4th in the Sun Belt play and ranking 150th in the final net rankings. The Cajuns do return two of their three double-digit scorers from last year in guards Brandy Williams and Lene Wheaton. Definitely not a totally harmless team. That's why they were one of the teams that I kind of... a little bit was on the borderline when I included them in the teams that Houston should beat. But this is a team that Houston beat by 12 points at home last year. The Cougs, I feel like, do return, more depth and talent than do the Raging Cajuns. So, even on the road, this is a team that if Houston is going to have the type of season that they want, Sam, this is a game that they definitely want to win.
Yeah, certainly not in the tier of the creme de la creme of this non-conference schedule, but like you said, an absolutely good enough team to beat you. And I think you always learn a bit more about yourself, whether it's a neutral site or away game, starting away from the friendly confines, like the Cougars will be doing this coming Monday.
All right, Sam, I think that is it. We are, over just a comfortable hour and a half. I thought maybe we were going to get up to 2 hours for this one, so I think we did a pretty good job of breezing through things as much as possible. But any last thoughts, Sam, on this? What has been a pretty meaty 400th episode?
We're less than 72 hours away, my friend, to having Cougar basketball, both men's and women's, in the books. That is really, really exciting.
Just could not be more excited about being a Cougar men's basketball season ticket holder this year, both this year and going forward, and really excited to see what the women are able to get to this year as well.
Yeah, I mentioned it really quick. I'm sure I'll mention it in real time. Won't belabor the point, but finalized the last of my trip to Oregon in a couple weekends to see the Cougs play the Ducks, and I'm very, very excited to see them in person against a good opponent.
Very nice. Very jealous of that one, but also not jealous that the fact that I actually get to live in Houston and have the season tickets to see them on a regular basis. So
are you going to be jealous of my 3 a.m. red eye back to my hometown?
Ooh, yeah, less jealous of that. It doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun, but you know what does sound like a whole lot of fun? Watching Marcus Sasser and everyone on this Cougar men's basketball team heading forward. So looking forward to that. The next time we come to you, I guess, I don't know, it depends on when we get our SMU recap episode up, but yeah, very well could be the next time we talk to you as podcasters that we've got some Houston Cougar basketball in the books, so very much looking forward to that. On our way out at this episode, as always, going to give a huge Scott Holman podcast thank you to our Patreon supporters. Would love to encourage you, if you enjoy this podcast on a regular basis and you feel like you're in a position where you can afford a couple of bucks a month, would love for you to go to shpodcast.com/support. You will find a link to make a recurring monthly donation on Patreon. You can also send us a one-time tip via PayPal or support us by buying some merchandise with our Straight Sign logo on it. We love hearing from you, the listener. You can email us, shpodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us at @shpodcast. That's it for us. Thank you so much if you made it all the way to the end. And as always,
go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Vamos los Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
We ain't invited to the party. We had to kick the door in. No cap. No cap. No cap. No cap.